Welcome to Beyond the Boundaries, a group relations podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ellen Short, and this is season two of the podcast, and the title and theme of season two is Capturing the Legacy and Future of Group Relations. And for this episode, our guest is, and our first guest for season two, is Dr. Kathleen Pogue White. Dr. White is an educator and reflective practitioner. She is also a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst. She is a supervising analyst in the postdoctoral program in psychology and psychoanalysis at New York University. She is a system psychodynamic organizational consultant. Dr. White is also a group relations practitioner and a founding member of the William Allison White Psychoanalytic Institute organization program, also known in terms of acronyms as WAWI. Dr. White is the founder and co-director of the Chocolate Salon, also known as TCS. She's the co-founder and co-chair of Black Psychoanalysts Speak, BPS, the co-founder of the Gould Center, Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, which is IPTAR, I-P-T-A-R. Dr. White is also a distinguished member of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations, which is ISPSO. She is a fellow for the Institute for the Study of Social Systems. The acronym is ACRI, A-K-R-I, also known as the A.K. Rice Institute for the Study of Social Systems. And Dr. White is a fellow also for the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, again, also known as IPTAR. And we're going to give you during this episode, two links, one to Black Psychoanalysts Speak and also one for the Chocolate Salon. And we will also have those links on our resource page. I also want to add one more thing. Dr. White is the author of what I consider to be an excellent article entitled Surviving Hating and Being Hated, Some Personal Thoughts About Racism from a Psychoanalytic Perspective. And that is in the Journal of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, published in 2002. And I call Dr. White Kathy. So I want to welcome you, Kathy, to Beyond the Boundaries, and just tell you how delighted I am to have you here as our first guest.
I'm delighted to be here, considering our relationship. It's a perfect one-on, right? We've had so many things together. So thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And speaking of our relationship, which is thank you for letting me get that segue in there. I want to, for the benefit of our listeners, I want to be even more transparent about the fact that we do have a professional and personal relationship. And I want to just give a little background, which of course you are very familiar with, about how we met. And this is one of the group relations narratives that you, the listeners will hear during the course of season two. But Kathy and I met doing a series of conferences at NYU that were founded by Dr. Mary McCrae. And the conferences ran, I think, from 1999 to maybe 2011, 2012, really long time. They were primarily focused on cultural issues, race, religion, gender identity, various intersectional identities that people have, and group dynamics related to them. And I was a doctoral student at that time. When the conferences began, I was a doctoral student and one of Dr. McCrae's students, and was very eager, coming from Chicago and having done group relations work a little bit there with Sonny Citrenbaum. I was very eager to work with Mary, and Mary was at a particular place that we often find ourselves in group relations and in other work roles where she very much wanted to take up her director role. But sometimes in group work, we want to take up roles, or we're hired to take up roles, and we're not quite sure how to do it. And we call it taking up the role. And so my version of this story is that Mary did a really, really interesting and smart thing, which is that she contracted with Kathy for Kathy, who had much more experience, to mentor her in how to become a director. And when I say mentor, I mean in real time during the conferences. And of course, before and after, there was work done, I'm sure, between the two of you. But Kathy took up that role. She agreed to do it. And she was in various roles, associate director, according to my recollection, also director, I believe. And the last thing I will say about it is that it was just an exceptional experience for me, because I met Kathy and experienced her and began to learn from her. And also, I had the privilege of watching two Black women work in taking up their authority roles in a collaborative way in a predominantly white institution in group relations work. And I was a witness to that, and I learned from that. And it has impacted my work from that time. And so I just wanted to give the listeners my narrative about how we met, and what a remarkable experience it was. It was hard. It was hard work, and there were lots of interesting things that happened. But in my memory, it was very special.
So one of the things that happened was that as you were mentored by Mary, I mentored Mary. So one of the things that happened is we gave ourselves family titles. And so I am your grandma.
You are.
You know, you are. And it's just the most wonderful feeling that comes often in group relations, that we get connected to each other when we're working together, and those connections can last a lifetime. I'm aware of the fact that some of my relationships go back 50 years.
Wow. Yeah.
And it, not that we see each other all the time or whatever, but whenever one connects, it's like it was just yesterday, you know, those conversations pick up where they left off. It's great.
You pick up where you left off. And when you said that, I have some relationships not quite that long, but getting there, getting to that point in group work and outside of group work. And I was wondering, for me, it doesn't seem like it's been decades, but how does it seem to you?
It does not feel like decades at all. I think it has to do with the fact that maybe I see somebody I love dearly every other year. You know, so the time in between collapses the time a bit, right? So I was just talking to somebody this morning, actually, in group relations, who my age, my stage, one of my fellow travelers, I guess, mm-hmm. who said that he went away to vacation and in his home country, and people said, you look just the same. And so we had a laugh because this dude does not look the same as he did 20 years ago, right? So it's been 20 years. It's not, no, really, not really. But it's one of those things I guess people do. I have a picture of you in my mind, and so that's what I see when I see your old face,
I think
your gray hair.
Exactly. I think that is true. And I also, you know, Kathy, when you're saying that, I also feel like that is actually lovely in a way, because sometimes people, you know, we sometimes lose people who knew us 20 years ago.
That's
or,
right.
You know, earlier in our lives. And that's so it's, right. I think in a way, even though it probably wasn't accurate in terms of the reality of it, of how he had changed or your friend had changed, it has meaning that people remember us and they hold a part of our identity and our history, you know, in knowing us. And I think that happens in our work a lot.
Mm-hmm. So it's a big family.
It is a big family. You know, I think of it also, like you do, as lineage. And, you know, it just really is wonderful that I am your grandbaby and that you are my grandmother in the work. I love that, and it means a lot to me. And, you know, we have to treasure those relationships, as you were saying.
We do. We do. So, you know, I was with the initial group of folks who started doing the work over here. And so I felt very much like Margaret Riok's daughter, because she took me in, you know.
Yes.
So gave me my opportunity. So, you know, even from the beginning, it felt so it had a family kind of quality to it. And, you know, family also means you can get really pissed off at people and be in these little wars for 2 or 3 years or whatever, right? It's like family for real.
That's what happens with family. I mean, you know, sometimes people say family and we think of happiness and peace and all of these wonderful things, but mm-hmm. we know very well that our real family lives are dysfunctional. And so for me, because of group relations, whenever I hear someone who's not in the work say that, I think, uh-oh. So I have two questions for you before we begin with the formal questions. Can you say a little bit about over here, when you talk about over here, are you talking about in the United States group relations?
United States group relations, because of course you know it's global. And even though we started the work over here, in the States, the first group relations work through Margaret came to the United States first and then spread out. And I might not have that completely right, because there are all the other organizations over there. Now I'm talking London and surrounds. There's the Tavistock, right, which has been doing work forever, though the person who started the group relations movement started it at the Tabby sort of in the 50s.
Yes.
But before that, there's the GRUB, which is an organization that's more centered on issues around religion rather than issues of authority. I can't think of it. It's the person that does the double task work.
Hmm. Okay.
Can't remember his name right now. Bridger. Bridger was working, you know, before the Tabby started making group relations an institutional fact at the Tabby. So it's hard to say where this work actually started, but the formal group relations that you and I practice started in London with Eric Miller and people.
Yes, that's really, I think that will be helpful for our listeners. And then I want to pull one more piece from that you mentioned, which is about Margaret Riok. Can you tell us who Margaret Riok was and your relationship with her?
Yes, Margaret Riok was a very intense, brilliant white woman who had, I think her degree was in literature, something like that. And she went over, was invited over to the Tabby to one of these early group relations meetings, fell in love with it and a guy, and they came back to the States ready to just, you know, build the castle. There's a lot to say about Margaret. I don't know if you want me to, like, go for it, but
You may say whatever you feel comfortable saying about Margaret. I know you knew her. Many of us in the work, you know, generationally speaking, never met her. I never met her. I have read about her. So I have no knowledge of her personally. I've seen photos. I know she was close to Dr. Wells. I know you had a relationship with her. But please, tell us whatever you want.
She was a force of nature, this woman. And she had a very sort of soft, quiet way about her, but she had like steel in her grip, you know. And she had preferences that we still have the legacy of the preferences. Her preferences were for highly intelligent Jewish guys. And those were the people she had around her and the only people she supported, except for three black women. So there was Rita Dumas, Jackie Robinson's wife is...
Rachel Robinson?
Rachel Robinson, Rose Miller, and Kathy White, says four. So for some reason, we all assumed she must have had a nanny. Or, you know, there's some connection to black women that was powerful enough for her to override her preference for men to bring us in.
Interesting.
You know, y'all come. I mean, you know, she like reached out to get all four of us, not at the same time, but I came in fourth.
So you were the last of the four to connect.
I think so, yeah. Yes, I am. Because the next person was a white woman from the Midwest, I think, whose name is not going to come to me.
That's okay. Can you, I'm curious, can you just share a little bit about the four of you and how you all related to each other in this, what I'm describing it this way. It may not have felt that way. Sort of a vortex of Margaret and her influence. How did you all connect and react to that and with each other? Because that those names, for some of our listeners, will be very familiar. For some, not. They're familiar to me. Although I never met Rita again, I was deeply affected by her writing. But the other three that you mentioned, I have, of course, and the other two, and of course you. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, indeed. So I'm going to start with Rita because I had the most direct work contact with her. Both Rita and Rachel were nurses who ran organizations. Nursing organizations, sub-organizations, whether, you know, in hospitals. And I don't know why I tell you that, but I'm thinking they were friends. I don't know that.
Okay.
But Rita was the first person I had the terrifying pleasure of doing a small group with. My first small group.
Can I just... interrupt for a minute. The terrifying pleasure is so appropriate for what happens when we do work with certain people. Go ahead.
I was so terrified, but I was terrified of the work, the members, and my partner. You know, and she was a smoker. And back in the day, you could smoke anywhere you wanted to. So she had her ashtray balanced on her leg, and she was lighting up her cigarettes. And I was like transfixed by how she was going to do all of that and listen and speak. It's like, oh, Jesus. But she did. She was brilliant. And she turned to me in the session and said, so what are you thinking?
Ooh, ooh.
People say, Kathy, you're just too courageous. I said, honey, I was brought up by some really courageous people in work.
Absolutely.
You know, I take big chances in work. I love it. And she was right. It's like, don't just sit there like a student. Yeah. Where are you? So I fumbled out something or another. And afterward, we had supervision, like, and that was just precious. Because, you know, she helped me see the dynamics that were going on that I had no clue about. It was great. So I must have done that with her maybe four times.
Okay.
And at the end of the four times, I felt like I might even be able to go into one of those by myself. So I guess that's the model I had in my mind from with Mary as a result of my work with Rita. I've never thought of that.
That's fascinating. This is the first time that you've made that connection?
First time, yes. Right.
So
very nice.
So interesting. So interesting. And I.
And you have a great grandmother.
I have a great grandmother. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I remember, thank you for sharing that. That is so vivid. That is such a vivid remembrance of Rita, and not one that usually gets talked about when I've heard people talk about her. With this, I love the cigarette and the balancing and the speaking and the consulting and then the turning to you. I think that's so great to think of her in that way. And what, you know, what I was thinking about was, first of all, I actually made a mistake. I don't know Rachel Robinson. I am very aware of her and was very impressed when I heard that she was part of our work. And I have met Rose. I did meet Rose, and never worked on staff or was never a member of any of her conferences. But just the connection that you're making between the four of you to Margaret is something that I have not heard in a collective context. I've heard individual stories, your story, Rose occasionally spoke about her, but really mostly from you. And so this is, I think it's really a precious memory.
Yes, and there's a precious heartache in here too. I think the only person I actually worked with was Rita. And, you know, all of us were alive for 20 or so years, you know? All of us were like active for... Never were any of us ever on a staff together.
May I say some? May I ask? I have a something to say about that, but may I ask you why you think that happened or didn't happen?
Well, the only people who actually counted in the organization were the white Jewish guys, and so they essentially brought each other along.
Yeah,
and it was a long time before any one of them who and these the. The center circle of guys, about seven of them, and they were all connected to university, and so they were putting on conferences all the time, and so it wasn't for lack of opportunity for them to hire a woman, a black woman. They did
right.
hire women, but it was, oh well, you know, white is right. If you're black, step back. Same old.
This is so meaningful because I had a conversation not too long ago with a colleague. I won't name her, but she and I are close. And it was around the time that we lost, Rose and Earl and Kimberly. And I don't know if you remember, but there was, and I don't know if you were there, but ACRI did have a I won't even say it was an event. I think it was an experience of us to collectively grieve the losses of our three black colleagues. And after that happened, I had a conversation with my friend, and we were talking about how we didn't really know them all that well from the work. And a lot of the memories that were coming forth, you know, when ACRI held the memorial, and, you know, on our listserv, Kathy, were from the white ACRI members, which were, and I want to be clear about this, I appreciated them. They were meaningful. But there was, you know, I was talking with my friend, and we were just kind of like, there's not very many black folks, you know, commenting or writing in, and it could be cultural differences around grieving and memorializing someone. But the other thing that I really want to say to connect exactly to what you're saying was that we know that we came to the conclusion, and we know that we didn't get to work with them very much because we are not hired in a collective context for conferences, just like what you said. We are hired, one black person, maybe two black people, or one person of color who is not black. That is the way that we have been hired for ACRI conferences since I certainly have been a part of the organization and doing the work. And obviously, since you began. And so we have, it actually made me quite sad that we have missed opportunities. And what you're saying also, you missed opportunities to work with each other and to see the brilliance of, you know, your colleagues. And I felt the same way, and I still feel that way. So that's just something I wanted to share, to connect with what you just said.
Right. Let me balance it out, though. You know, I had quite a long experience with Wells. He and I got to be buddies, but always on the opposite side of whatever. And the thing that stands out the most about Leroy Wells and me is that we were members together in an all-Black conference, all Black members and all Black staff, if you can imagine.
I can.
Earl was on staff, and he was my small group taker. And in the intergroup, there was this intense wish to disrupt the staff, murder the staff, get rid of the staff, headed by Wells. Headed by me was the, let's negotiate with them for some chairs to sit in and be a part of the doohickey. So we had our sides, and our sides were intense. But anyway, at some point, it was really clear that I was going to win this one. And Wells said, "White, you are too white."
Wow.
I will never forget that as long as I live.
Very intense.
The worst thing he could call me was white.
White. And what was your reaction to it?
Yeah, right. That's true, probably. What do you want from me?
Yeah. That's a dynamic. You know, that's the dynamic between the two of you that was very powerful, that was probably representing a lot that was going on that was unspoken.
Yes. I would say that was probably, this in the unconscious way, his permission for me to get in touch with the white parts of myself as part of my journey. And that has been my journey, right? So there's, in some ways, I think of my advance in being able to be myself for real is connected to him, because he's one of the people I just genuinely loved in this life, you know. Mm-hmm. There is a picture, I hope this picture still exists, you know, because he was having trouble getting a woman and having a marriage. So finally he met this woman, he was totally in love with her. They got married and they had this baby in the first whatever year. And he sent around a picture. You remember that Wells was huge. He sent around a picture with his hand and this little baby in it. It was like, oh, you could just die from happiness. And I told somebody about this and they said, look, I think that picture still exists. We tried to get it together for his funeral. You talk about losses, man.
Yes.
So about Wells and Black people, his funeral was jam-packed with Black people. And that made, you know, he was like the father of a whole lot of up-and-coming folks out of Howard. So right. That may have had a lot to do with it, yeah.
Yeah, it probably did have a lot to do with it. I want to, first of all, the story is very powerful of the work that you both did. And the unconscious dynamics that he may have picked up on around you getting in touch with your whiteness. I want to also connect with you on that and say that when I met you on the NYU conference staff, one of the things that attracted me to you was that you were doing that work. And what I liked about it was that you were naming, you were open and transparent about the white men that you had worked with, who had helped you. I don't know if they were mentoring you, but they helped you, and that you had learned from. And I really liked that because I had a similar situation as well. The first person who I connected with around group work was Sunny. So, oh. Yeah. So I was very curious about that, and I admired your ability to be able to speak about it in the way that you were, sort of questioning, exploring, but very definite about, yes, this is part of my legacy as well.
Oh, so true. I wouldn't be sitting in this chair talking to you hadn't been for all those white guys who took a shine to my work and to me as a person and gave me opportunity after opportunity. It's like, oh, we found one. We can work with her. It was true at Lester, at the Tavi as well. Oh, we found one. So, I was over there years in a row,
I know you were. Yeah, I remember that. I always used to check for the staff and see. Kathy's there. Kathy's there. Let me say one more thing. Also, I never met Dr. Wells because he passed right before I got into the work.
Oh,
and maybe even the year that I started, that I did my first conference with Sunny at Northwestern.
Yeah,
but I. The description that you just had of him and what was talked about at the memorial event for the 25th anniversary of his passing, all of those stories were so interesting, including the one that you just told about him, because it makes him more alive and more real to me. And I want to also say that I want to counter something too before we get to the questions, because I'm gonna segue into that. And I want to say that I do believe that we have missed out on opportunities to work with each other as Black colleagues, but I also had exceptional experiences working with Black colleagues and being directed by them at NYU. That was my experience. I wouldn't have met you or quite a few other people, Medria, Zachary, all of the people that were there. I would not have met them had it not been for those conferences. So I like that you balance it. I like that you talked about the conference that you did with Wells, and it helped me remember, that I had a decade basically of working with Black colleagues that just are exceptional in the work.
Still exceptional.
And still exceptional.
That's yes, right. Indeed.
That's right. So I want to just ask you just a few of the questions that we had talked about before. And the first one is, could you just speak a little bit about how you were introduced to group relations work and what initially attracted you to the work?
Well, the story will lead you to understand that I was not attracted to the work. I was attracted to the people.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about the work. As a matter of fact, I was a clinician seeing individual patients. In private practice quite early in my life because I was also trained as a social worker. So I had a practice from my social work training before I got to analyst training.
Mm-hmm.
So I met this man, fell in love with him like nobody's business. I can tell you his name because his name should be around because he's part of us, Harris Arnold. And Harris Arnold and Larry Gould had been to some training situation at the Tavistock, and they became best friends. And Harris came away from the training a year before Larry. When he came back, Larry came back, we had a fast and furious sportsome friendship. And so all of us got really close, etc. Then Harris had surgery that was planned, and he didn't survive it. So his two best friends, me and Larry, somehow got joined at the hip in the sense that we spent a lot of time together mourning and talking and cleaning his house and all of that stuff, which can, either kill you or make a friend out of you.
Yes.
We became fast friends in terms of telling each other kind of our opinion about directions. And his opinion about my direction was that if I didn't take a group relations conference, I would never mourn Harris. And so it's like, how much do I have to do for this friendship? I was completely not interested on any level. But, you know, when you are having this sort of clingy relationship with a fellow traveler who is mourning the same as you are, et cetera. And by the way, we were decided to go into training at the same time. So it's like, he followed me, I followed him, he followed me, you know, it was like that. So I gave in and said, okay, I'll do it. And of course it changed my life, right? First conference knocked me out of the ballpark. Just knocked me over. Knocked me over with stuff I didn't know about myself. But the most important thing happened in the review and application group. So one of the click boys was my group application taker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking, you know, I have my PhD now, and I'm like cute, and I'm teaching, and he said, after I told him what my troubles were in work, which were none, because I was so cool, he said, is this all you're going to do in your life? It's like, stab right to the heart. It penetrated so deep. I thought I was I got breathless, and it's like, take a mask and just rip it off. So I felt exposed and vulnerable. Who, me vulnerable in front of people? Are you kidding?
Mm-hmm.
Vulnerable and all of that stuff. And said and did. I said, well, I guess I have to quit my job. I was teaching, and I quit. I did, because I realized, well, I say it differently now because I'm much more experienced with how the world works. But what I would say now about then that I had to get away from was I was being cannibalized. Oh, our black professor. Oh, let's take her over here and show her. And let's take her over here and show her. It's like, so I was walking away from the ways in which I let myself be fake. And his interpretation is just like, okay, you're being fake. Get out.
Very powerful.
Oh, honey, you don't know. Yes, you do. You know. It's extremely powerful stuff. So Larry was not surprised. And he had this, pardon me, shitty grin when I told him that I was going to leave my job. He said, I told you it was powerful, didn't I? It is. So I got to love the work by being exposed to it. It didn't call me, you know, it like owned me. When I got close to it, it's like, okay, I'm absorbed, I'm in. It had a lot, that experience led to my getting a lot of requests to be on staff. Because people could see that was like, oh yeah, right, that's what we want, people to see themselves and be able to put it into words. And now it feels like I am group related. You know, it's like, it's just me. You know, it's what I think about, what I do. But I don't think about it in terms of theory, et cetera, et cetera. I think about the way in which I have applied it, right? I apply it to everything. You know, I don't use the terms and all like that. But when I'm consulting in these big organizations, I got Margaret Riach is with me. Melody
right.
Klein is with me.
Right.
Bion is with me. All those folks. I'm always like in the weeds of the organization, even though I've been asked to come and work with the senior team. As a matter of fact, I have said to myself a number of times, you're a little off here because nobody asked you to wonder about the relationship to the board.
No one asked you. Yes.
Nobody
I say to myself often, no one asked you anything about whatever that may be. Yes, yes. But you know what?
But,
can I just say something also?
Yes.
I don't want to interrupt, but I want to just kind of connect with you around the significance of you, of what you said about being introduced to the work. It had nothing to do with group relations work. I really want to emphasize that for our listeners, and it's just really interesting to me as well. You, if I'm hearing you correctly, came to the work because of your love of a man that died, and you were in grief mode, and you also had through Larry, you know, someone who, you know, metaphorically could take you by the hand and say, "Let do this thing, do this." And what I like about that is that I think that sometimes people think that they need to know a lot about group work before they go to a conference.
Oh, right.
And that's not necessarily true, right?
Not at all. Not at all. I knew nothing. And plus, I was hostile toward the idea of group. You know,
well,
so I came in with
people like, are. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, show me or give me my money back. It's, you know, I was hostile all the way through until this dude called my number.
Right. And that's the second thing I wanted to just sort of pull out a little bit, is to say that you encounter, when you do these conferences, you encounter people who see you in ways that you really just aren't able to see yourself. And that's very powerful. And sometimes they will, as this gentleman did, will tell you what they see.
What they see.
Right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Somebody can see across the boundary that I am up. Are you kidding? So yeah. The answer is yes, people can, and you should.
That's an excellent observation about how Black people will relate to other Black people and not necessarily say the thing that they see. I mean, maybe your family will, but that's a different dynamic. That's a different group dynamic. But what I like about what you said is often, you know, because of respectability politics, and we get our education and we get all of the things that we feel like we need to have to be out in the world, because we do need to have them, particularly as Black women. And then someone sees you in a particular kind of way. And it didn't take away from all that you were at that time, but what it sounds like to me that it did, it was such a powerful experience that it made you reevaluate how you were being seen elsewhere.
Well, and how I was being.
And used. Yes. Yes.
So, yeah, the guy caught me being inauthentic. I was showing off.
Yes.
And in the sense he was saying, you know, hello, but tell me something real, okay?
Yeah.
So what I take from that, both as a psychoanalyst and as a citizen, let me get back to citizen, that's the wrong word, as a person on the planet, is that if I see something about a person and I offer it to them, it's a gift of love.
Yes.
Because it's like, if I see it, I want to give it to you.
Yes.
So in psychoanalysis, you have to contain that a bit and do it in a way that was essentially helping the person see it for themselves, right? That's why it took so much time, until I learned that I could just tell people what I thought and it would make a difference on the spot.
Well, I think that's one of your gifts in the work, your ability to do that. And that clearly people saw that in you in your first conference. Even though you were experiencing all these new things, you were able to actually speak about them and work with it, right? Yeah. And I think that's why you began to get hired and recognized in the work. And I do think it's a gift to be able to do that. And you also have your clinical training as a psychoanalyst, which
makes a difference. I think
makes a big difference. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So
I think it's an important difference. I think in some ways I've been authorized by the white establishment to be authentic in the blackest place I have.
Yes.
That makes sense?
Say more. Say more about that.
Well, my capacity to see comes from my ancestors, right? I don't think it comes from being smart. I think I had ancestors that had this trait. And there are, you know, older people in my family who have the trait. And they learned what I had also learned, which is to keep it to yourself. So you go into psychoanalytic training and they are telling you, You know that thing that you're not supposed to do? That's what you're supposed to do.
Yes, yes. Because the keep, am I right in saying to you that the way that we are taught, the keeping it to yourself, because I was taught that as well. I would say and do things in my family and people would, you know, it would just be like, no. That's inside voice or inside talk. We don't do that, you know, in public or what have you. I had that same dynamic. But it's also for our survival, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to essentially call too much attention to yourself because you'd be in trouble. You'd be in danger.
You'd be in danger. You know, yeah, but then you get into the white environment. The psychoanalytic environment, for me, it was the counseling psychology environment and the group relations environment. And that is what makes you actually be seen in the work and valued in the work. It's so remarkable, that ability to be able to see and say what you see and to contextualize it in a way, as you, you know, really said so well, in a way that is acceptable.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something that be at my most ordinary, homegrown South Side of Chicago self is acceptable?
Yes, yes. Not only acceptable, desired and admired, and people also want to be like you in the work very much.
Give that, yeah. In the work, yeah.
In the work. I had just a really quick story. I had a conference situation in which something came up and I was asking for something that I thought needed to be done. And a colleague got annoyed with me and said to me, "Who do you think you are, Kathy White?" And it took me aback.
Whoa!
Yes, it took me aback for a moment. And then I thought, no, but yes, and thank you.
Really? Oh my God, do you know what you were doing?
Yes, I don't want to get too much into the weeds with it, but I was an associate director, and I was asking for something that I needed to have for my comfort to do my work, and it was objected to.
Who do you think you are? Oh, I love
it. And to be honest with you, it was a small thing. It was a small thing, but there was just a lot going on, and it just came out with this person. And I never told you this, but I always remember it fondly because I thought it was a compliment. I was like, oh, well, something is.
Yes, different. I guess. I guess I do.
Yes, my lineage was showing, I guess, right?
Right.
So I think we have kind of gone into already what group relations work means to you personally and professionally in terms of how you began, how you view it. And what I would like to ask you is to reflect on something that you'd said earlier in our other meeting, where you said it's in your soul, group relations is in your soul. And then I would like you to talk a little bit about your application of it and how you do that work. But let's I hope you don't mind my bringing that up again, but that was so wonderful and powerful to me. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's in my soul, honey. And what I'm it conflates several things. I found my soul is Black.
Yes.
This is like life learning. It didn't connect that way until it did, which was, you know, in the group relations beginning. I didn't think about myself as, you know, an emanating being that had impact and influence and internal stuff that was good. Didn't think about it. So the group relations events. You, listen, I was a member for, I don't know, 30 times, right? So I really, really did. I still do. I still go as a member.
You were a member at some of the, at least one NYU conference, I remember. And you were a member at another conference that I was on staff at. I know you do that work a lot.
I do, because it keeps me in contact with the soulful self, right? In terms of, I get a chance to be just me without all of the, fittings. Not a psychoanalyst, not a whatever, not a coach, not a, I'm just Kathy, and we'll see what happens in terms of how we work together. So anyway, I don't think I touch into my soul as much otherwise as I do in conference life.
Okay.
So I think what I'm, when I said it's in my soul, I think I find that I'm not different from the tenets of group relations. It fits me. I'm it. It's me. It's, I don't know if that's making sense, but it's deeply, deeply, deeply ingrained in who I am. And that's why I come up with the chocolate salon, which I'll tell you a little bit about.
That was going to be my next question. Yes.
I'm very happy I heard you. But
please.
I want to put it in context of COVID. So COVID set me down for almost 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because at my age, of course, I've extended the careful period. I'm still careful. I don't go into big crowds. And if it's not outdoors, I probably don't do it. Around the 2 year mark, I realized that I was feeling happy. People are dying all over the place and the world is falling apart. And I'm starting to go, la, 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 la. I stopped being, I'm sort of paranoid by structure, but I have been paranoid vigilant, watching to make sure that I'm not in any kind of jeopardy with folks. So, and to the point where if there are too many white people walking toward me on my street, I walk in the street or I cross the street, especially if they're all guys. It's like, now I'm not even going to, no thanks. I don't want to even see the looks on their faces, which is sometimes just sort of sweet and cute. And, oh, a colored person. I don't want to have anybody ask me anything. I don't want anybody spit across me. I don't want anybody to call me a nigger. But I realized that I wasn't having any microaggressions at all in 2.5 years. Nada. So when I figured that out, I thought, oh, so what's happening to me is that my nervous system is calming down because I'm not under threat 24/7. And as I got less and less high strung and crazed, I started to make up things in my mind that I wanted to do. And one of the things I want to do, still want to do this badly, is to see if I can't duplicate that experience of having folks get their, sensitivities down. And I think it's doable given our practice in group relations. It's like telling it to the group means that other people are sharing it with you, and other people get it because they're sharing it and they're connected to you through the same experience. And so storytelling, like we're doing today,
yeah.
Storytelling is so healing.
Absolutely.
And so I came up with the chocolate salon for clinicians because, we have to be Black clinicians taking in all the projections in the world. It's like, are we crazy? On top of everything else? So I have this thought about Black people who become clinicians. We're a special group of some kind of neurosis or something. That, in a sense, it feels like I know how to do projections because that's why I've been doing that all my life. And so allowing people to project into one is part of the skill base.
Yes, it is.
And so it could be that those of us who do it somehow are drawn to what is foisted on us by reason of the culture. We have to be able to take in projections.
Absolutely.
And survive, you know, and live. But live on the edge of madness all the time. I'm sorry. It's awful.
Absolutely. And, you know, what you're saying, Kathy, also makes me think about the dual role of taking all of that in, working through all of the projective processes, which can be very ugly and very difficult. But still, as a clinician, having to be able to contain the projections of patients and clients, and to be, in a sense, healers, and to support their growth and their learning and their work. And I am not, I don't do clinical work professionally, but I do consultation. And I was a professor for many years. And the process can be similar with regard to holding on to my own projections, but containing. I think one of the most interesting things that I learned about teaching is containment. That students need to be contained within the system, and you need to be aware of what's going on in the system in order to do your work. And then you also have to work with those projections that you get as women, as well as Black people.
And the other thing, I think, is age.
Yes.
Because those young kids can be vicious.
They can. They can.
Yeah. About age, yeah.
Absolutely. Can you want to say, first of all, before I ask you to elaborate on the chocolate salon, if you wish to, I think what you said about your period of being more solitary and not so out in the world during the pandemic is really powerful. And I have actually read a couple of articles, and I experienced it as well, because it was the time that I decided to leave my institution right before the pandemic, right before. My timing was so unusual. I resigned a month before the pandemic. But I stayed on as chair, but we were doing everything virtually. So, but my point is that I felt it too, the decrease in microaggressive dynamics. I was less vigilant about being out in the world the way that you described as well. And I've also read that there have been other people of color who have who felt the exact same way of really being able to not have that noise and not have to deal with the effects of that trauma that we are always having to manage in our worlds was a very interesting experience. So I really appreciate you speaking to that, and what was born out of that was the chocolate salon, along with many other things.
Yes, reborn was my creativity.
The chocolate salon is only one example of your creativity, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But this is a big step out. This is more sort of public, because I assume, like you, I've been in a cocoon of kind of work and people and institutions. And so this is putting myself out there into the world to say, I think Black people have something they need to work on. I think it's needing a space to be done in, and here's a space. Big deal for me. And by the way, sweetheart, let me tell you, I got a lot of pushback from Black people. Well, I can't come.
Yeah. Can you speak on that a little bit, please?
Yes. What I mean by stepping out was I have stepped on top of some taboos and just said, yeah, I'm stepping on these taboos.
Yes.
So, because, all of my white liberal friends expect that, you know, we're soulmates. So how could you go do something without me? So I put up with a lot of, like, you know, snubbing their nose kind of thing. But people who want to talk, the talk is about really understanding that we're different for the first time. Because I've, like, said, no, you don't belong to this group.
Right.
This group has particular, you know, I got this word from Medria. Particularity.
Particularity. And we say that Dr. Medria Connolly is one of our colleagues as well.
She was talking about reparations.
She is has written a paper with Brian Nichols, a fantastic paper about reparations, and actually has agreed to be a guest on the podcast series. So we're going to hear more about that.
Oh, great. Listen, yeah. How are you advertising the podcast? Because this is the first time I heard of it.
It was started in 2020, and season one had four really wonderful hosts. That's available to be listened to. Manny was one of the hosts. It's on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So it was advertised through GRI, but we are planning to advertise season two and season one as well through ACRI and, of course, GRI. I'm going to work on some other ways of advertising. We haven't gotten to it's a great question, so thank you for asking it. I don't want to do too many spoiler alerts with the guests, but we do have some more guests lined up as well. So, and we're also going to have a resource page, Kathy. So we're going to put the link to your article, the link to the Chocolate Salon, and also the link to Black Psychoanalysts Speak on that resource page as well. I want to say the link now is www.blackpsychoanalystspeak.org and also the Chocolate Salon, one word, at gmail.com, right?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Now,
yes.
Go ahead.
You want me to talk about it a bit? Yeah,
I do. But can I say something about one thing that you said before you continue? Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say really quickly about your white colleagues trying to understand why they were not invited. We want to say maybe to come to the barbecue or to be a part of the Chocolate Salon. I think that is also something that happens with some of our white friends and colleagues around their privilege, right? To feel that they should be invited and should be able to participate in anything that they wish to.
Even if it's called black and not white, you know, it's like...
Right, right. And not really...
But I'm me. I'm me.
Right.
You know, you want me, right?
Right, it's me. I know it's the Chocolate Salon with black people. But, you know, why can't I come? And I think that experience, if, you know, it would be lovely and wonderful and meaningful if our white liberal colleagues could reflect on how many ways we have not been invited as black people to join various enterprises, as you always say.
And the other thing is to notice how we relish in our privilege to do this.
Absolutely.
I think that's one of the things that makes folks pissed off. Now, there's the other one, the backlash from black people.
Ah, say more about that.
I belong to a group of people, all black. And I said, okay, I'm going to do the Chocolate Salon. What do y'all think?
We say
zip,
we say zip, or we say crickets, right? Nothing.
Crickets, Eddie. Crickets. Absolutely nothing. So I was so hurt. I didn't say anything till the next time we were together. I said, "You realize y'all didn't say anything when I said the Chocolate Salon. What's up?" Crickets.
Crickets again.
And so subsequently, I have cornered one person at a time to say, what was that? And I have a lot of different answers. Mostly it's, you didn't invite me.
Wow. So ego, a little bit of ego. a little bit of being offended at not being invited as well. What was your response?
I didn't have a good, nice, you know, comeback. I just said, oh, I get it. I do get it. Being left out is a bitch. And so this is a good idea. And people want to be involved in it.
Well, you know, it's something to think about in terms of inclusion, exclusion. The way that people feel about being excluded, I think, comes up very powerfully in our group relations work. And this idea of being chosen, of not being chosen, of being seen, not seen, etc. I think, ironically, many Black colleagues in the work, in my experience, seem to have, and it's not a benefit really, because most of us are very good at what we do, but we are usually seen very quickly. But what is done with us and how we are treated is really, you know, in my opinion, you know, on that path after you are seen, how are you worked with, how are you used, and how do you feel about the visibility that you have that has meaning. So with the Chocolate Salon, I think you tapped into something really wonderful, but I also think you tapped into this issue of inclusion and exclusion and what that means to people.
Totally. Totally. And you don't know how much furiousness is going on in me. It's like, diversity and inclusion is such crap. Pardon me, everybody who does the work of diversity and inclusion. I read a book that essentially said, the billion-dollar heist, meaning that billions of dollars have been put into workplace issues around diversity, et cetera, et cetera. And what are the results?
Yes.
So I think that until we understand our particularities, Black people, white people, you know, Puerto Rican people, Dominican Republican people,
right,
Spanish people, until we get it, we cannot possibly have empathy, because it's not based on anything that is known inside, right? So knowing inside is all that we have to do in order to be able to treat people well.
Yes.
But this business of I can't know myself because it's too hard, it's taboo and whatever.
It's painful.
And I'm neurosis, my neurosis and my pain and my blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Is in the way of diversity and inclusion. And it's like you can't program self-awareness.
You can't.
You can work on it.
It's a lifelong, would you say it's lifelong?
Lifelong,
right?
Lifelong work.
Right. And it's hard work. It can be very joyous. It can be very, you know, pleasurable, but it can also be very painful. Right?
Yes. I'm trying to squeeze out an agreement here. Because when you say it's painful, it's hard, and all like that. Yeah, what? What so? It's painful. It's hard. What? I don't understand why that's is a reason not to do something. I'm serious about this.
Kathy?
I'm with you
on that. When I say it's painful and it's hard, that's not a negative for me, actually.
So I'm with you. We're on the same page.
We're on the same page, because I tell you what I used to tell my students, you know, because they would complain about, I mean, they wanted to become counselors and therapists and marriage and family therapists, school counselors, etc. But they thought counseling was a happy profession. And then, you know, they would enter into the program and they would find out how complicated it really is. And one of the things I would say is exactly what you just said, which is that, you know, great ideas and innovations and progress usually doesn't come from a place of comfort. It comes from a place of discomfort. And counseling is not a comfortable profession. Neither is psychoanalysis, other forms of therapy, not comfortable. So I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm with you on this.
Good. I'm not surprised, actually. But I did get a little worked up. I get worked up about stuff.
I know. Sometimes. I know. But you know, the thing is that people do not want to be uncomfortable. So to go back to that, to emphasize that, you know, I'm all for that, but many people are not.
Yeah, I know. It's like, don't ask me to give up my dream of the American dream of perfectness, completeness, fulfilledness. Oh, man. Every now and then I get to the melting pot in my head and I think, oh, man, so many fraudulent ideas got like thrown on us. It's like, yeah. The melting pot being one of them. Melting pot.
Yeah, that's a very fraudulent image and a fraudulent idea. Another one that I used to talk about when I was teaching, that we needed to deconstruct that a little bit. But we are coming towards, we've talked about so many things, so many interesting things. We are.
I know. That's amazing, right?
We are. It is amazing. It is amazing. We're coming towards the end of our time. And I wanted to ask you, regrettably, if there's anything else that you wanted to talk about or with regard to, I love what you've said about the Chocolate Salon. Are there any other projects that you wanted to speak about, any or just anything that you just wanted to share with us?
Right. Well, I do want to share that we just experienced what I think is the healing experience, which is we got to talking and we just started to talk and we talked about stuff we both love.
Yes.
And care about. And I feel better. I wasn't feeling bad, but I feel kind of uplifted, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm working on taxes and it's like, yeah, I'll do my taxes. No, no problem.
Oh, I feel uplifted. Thank you for saying that. I feel uplifted. Yeah. I feel, really privileged to be able to have this time with you, to speak with you about the many things that we spoke about. And we don't see each other as often
enough
as we should, right? So this is really special and we, of course, are going to see each other again under different circumstances, but this is a special circumstance that we are sharing with others as well.
Yeah.
So
I really like the idea that you've asked me very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was my absolute pleasure. And I want to tell you how much I admire you. I think you know that, how much I respect you. I love you. And have great affection for you. And so this is an honor for me that you agreed to do this.
Well, I love my little girl, my little baby, grandbaby girl. And
you.
I do anything she asks me, almost. I don't know what the other side of that looks like, but if you ask me something that I thought was crazy, I would say so.
I know you would. I know you would. So I have no doubt about that. But thank you so much for doing this, Kathy.
Okay, honey. This was wonderful to do, to walk down memory lane a bit.
Absolutely.
All right, honey.
It was wonderful to do with you, and it was wonderful for me to have this experience of you and with you. Beyond the Boundaries, a Group Relations podcast, was produced and edited by Emmanuel Manny Molin, and is a Group Relations production. Thank you so much for listening.